and welcome to Literary Loitering. We are the Geek Show podcast all about book type things and arts. Yes. Sometimes we do arts.
Sometimes we do crafts as well.
Yes, that's in our own time.
And if we got enough dogs, we'll do crufts.
So is that an extra idea? The Geek Show does crufts.
No. It's my dog grooming service that I'm going to be creating arts and crufts.
Well then. Anyway, that's Rob. I'm Andrew.
Hello.
We've got stuff to do today.
Yes, we're going to get straight in. So the Man Booker International Prize has announced its shortlist, and they are Jose Eduardo Agualusa's A General Theory of Oblivion from Angola, and that's translated by Daniel Hahn. Elena Ferrante's The Story of the Lost Child from Italy, and that's translated by Anne Goldstein. Han Kang's The Vegetarian from South Korea. Han Kang's The Vegetarian from South Korea, and that's translated by Deborah Smith. Yan Lianke's The Four Books from China, and that's translated by Carlos Rojas. Orhan Pamuk's A Strangeness in My Mind from Turkey, and that's translated by Ekin Oklap. Rob Seetaler's A Whole Life from Austria, translated by Charlotte Collins. So some interesting titles there. The Four Books and A Strangeness in My Mind are two titles that I've got my interest.
I have literally nothing to add to this.
Yes, you have literally nothing to add to this. But anyway, yeah, we'll find out more about those books.
Yeah, we will. Like when later it on. Comes yeah. More time to one of them winning.
Yes, when it's
that was time. A sentence that I phrased.
Yes, we do words good. We have words.
It's okay, Rob. No one will be able to tell that we're both ill. The show will go fine.
Yes. No raspy voices here. Anyway, moving on to the main news.
Yes, the big news. Shall I begin?
Yes.
Well, first up, we have the news that Neil Gaiman is going to adapt Good Omens, the book he wrote with Terry Pratchett, into a TV series.
Which I'm curious about how they're going to do, because it's a very British apocalypse.
So I've been told, although this had made me realise that I haven't read Good Omens.
And I am severely disappointed.
I'm severely disappointed in me as well. Like, I don't know how I haven't.
And it's not really a title that can slip under the radar.
No.
It's a collaboration by two amazing authors, and they wrote an amazing book, which was basically The Omen, but Pratchett style. Basically, you know the basic gist of Good Omens, so don't you?
Sort of, in that like it deals with the antichristy type thing, well, end of the world type scenario.
Imagine the scenario like this. You know The Omen, the movie?
Yes.
Okay. You know how the story of The Omen is that the child born to the American diplomat is switched at birth with the Antichrist, right? They don't actually give birth to the Antichrist. They basically do the whole switcheroo thing at birth. So they think they've got their son, but they haven't. They've actually got the devil's son, right?
Which, you know, what I've always wanted more than that film is the story of, like, the American diplomat's son in hell.
Well, see, this is the thing. This is basically what would happen if the order who was basically doing the whole American diplomat switcheroo was an order of chattering nuns, and they weren't actually very good at their job. And it just so happened that another couple were in that hospital that night, and they were also having a son, and they were just a normal couple. And
they accidentally got the Antichrist.
Yeah, they accidentally got the Antichrist. The American diplomat got their son, and the American diplomat's son went on to do something else, you know.
Had wacky adventures in hell.
I don't think it was wacky adventures in hell. They just basically put him up for adoption or something like that.
No, shush. This is the Omen spin-off that I've always wanted. And in my mind, it's beautiful.
Oh, no. Because, you know, when the Antichrist reaches a certain age, they get the Hellhound, and then the Omen, it was basically a Rottweiler-type dog. Well, in this, it's kind of like Waffles from Discworld. He appears as this, you know, slavering, glowing red eyes Hellhound, and the boy says, you know, I want a dog, but he's going to be like this, and describes the dog, and because it's his master saying it, he turns into a small yappy dog. Who finds it inordinately fun to bark at cats and trees. And it's just kind of yeah, this is a very British apocalypse.
No, no, it's really good. I think another thing with the story is apparently, I think what I've got confused with, I thought we'd already covered this story, but I think what it was it was planned, but then Neil Gaiman said he wasn't going to do it after Terry Pratchett passed.
Yeah.
Because they had an agreement that they would work, if it ever got adapted to TV, they would work on it together.
Yeah.
But apparently he's now received a posthumous letter from Terry Pratchett telling him that he should go on and do it himself.
Wow.
Yeah, and so Neil Gaiman's kind of honouring that wish to make this TV series.
I mean, I miss him. I really, really miss Terry Pratchett.
I think we all do.
But this is the thing, he was always thinking about the people who read his books and the people who just loved his work. And we've always wanted to see Good Omens on TV or as a movie, just for the sheer hell of it. I mean, Sky have done a decent job with the Discworld adaptations. I think Hogfather and The Colour of Magic.
Yeah, they were very well done.
And David Jason as Rincewind is just superb. Okay, as Albert, he was all right, but as Rincewind, he was a revelation. And who played Two Flower? Because that was brilliant.
It was Sean Austin, wasn't it? Samwise Gamgee. Yeah.
Samwise Gamgee. He was brilliant as Two Flower.
He was spot on.
Oh, and what was
it? And the sentient trunk they found to play luggage. He was very good as well.
And Tim Curry as the kind of the renegade wizard.
Yes,
he was great, and he just basically he was just being Tim Curry, but in that role he was more Tim Curry than Tim Curry normally is.
It's kind of transcended to the ultimate point of Tim Curry-ness.
Yes. The ultimate Tim Curry. Now it's starting to make me hungry.
You know, I've worked out why we haven't seen Tim Curry in recent years.
I didn't eat him, honest.
No. I think he became more Tim Curry than the universe could handle.
Oh, God. Does that mean that he had to have a separate Tim Curry universe created for him, just like Lucifer? And only those who've read the graphic novel of Lucifer know Lucifer. That. So, yeah, spoiler alert, sorry.
Although now I've made myself hungry as well by wanting to visit Curry World. I can enjoy a nice Indian meal and then buy a computer.
The capital of Curry World is Dopiyaza. Yes. With the pot city of Rogan Josh. Oh, right. And, what was it? The Dal Sea. It's a bit yellow and spicy. Oh, no. I just made up for myself. Oh, no. Oh, God. No. Back to Good Omens. Back to safe territory.
But yes, Good Omens. It's going to be a TV series.
I'm happy about this. But who could play the roles? You haven't read the book.
No, I haven't. I can't help you here. This is just a constant disappointment on my part.
Yeah, but I'm wondering how they're going to do the Hellhound, because the Hellhound has his own thoughts.
I'd assume maybe just like a narration voice.
Possibly, but in Good Omens, right at the beginning, they got the dramatis personae, and they basically got all of the characters listed. When it comes to the Hellhound, his name is Dog. That's his official name.
His name is just Dog.
Yeah, just Dog. And next to it, it says Satanic Hellhound and Cat Warrior. And I was hooked from that point onwards.
I'm sure they'll find a way to work it in.
Yeah. This is not disparaging Neil Gaiman in any way, because I really like his work as well. But I think without Pratchett, it's not going to be the same. Because I think with something like this, having his input would make it so very, very different.
Yeah, I think that's probably part of why he didn't want to do it.
Yeah.
I think it sounds like it's going to have a bunch of people working their absolute hardest on it, and I think it's still going to be very good what they make.
Neil Gaiman and Terry Pratchett were really, really close friends, and I think his editor, Rob Wilkins, I think he'll be involved as well, and I think Rhianna Pratchett as well will probably get involved.
I would assume so.
But I think that this is going to be more than just Neil Gaiman. I think that a lot of people who knew Terry and loved him and were close to him will probably get involved in this, just to try and channel some of that ultimate Pratchettness. Because it is the ultimate Pratchettness has seeped into all the fans of Discworld. We all worship at the feet of the Pratchettness.
Yes, yes. Terry Pratchett isn't gone. He's just diffused into all of us.
Yes, he has, and you know, every so often he'll appear, a bit like Buddha, only with a hat. So yeah, I think we can move on from there. I'm happy with the omens coming.
So what we've also got is the story that there is a company that will turn selfies into colouring books.
Where's Ryan when you need him?
Probably out buying one already.
Oh, this story is for all of those people who overuse Instagram and Snapchat and things like that. Because, I'm sorry, but that's like the ultimate form of narcissism. You take a selfie and then you can colour yourself in.
I think it depends on how good you are. It's either the ultimate form of narcissism or the ultimate form of self-hate.
True. But then again, you're fairly narcissistic if you're going around taking selfies all the time.
That's true. See, I think I know what the real goal of this is.
Oh.
It's aimed entirely at Frank Castle, the Punisher.
And explain.
So that he can take a selfie and get a nice, you know, black and white print out of it. Just pick up that brown colouring pencil and remember times gone past.
I was wondering where you're going with this, and I thought, oh, I know.
Where I'm going is very close to the edge.
It's not close to the edge at all, because it's been done.
Yes.
It's been done, folks, and we have proof.
Yes, Punisher was a black man at one point.
They blacked him up, and he was hanging out in Harlem with Luke Cage. It's true. 90s comics are a thing.
Comics is weird.
Yes. We're going to have to dig that out and put that on Instagram. Just because people don't believe us.
Yeah. You know, the sad thing is, it's called, like, Colour Me Book.
Yeah.
And apparently, like, they'll happily do any photo. And yet the line they've gone with this is just selfies.
I'm concerned
about
the...
I feel like there's a lot of potential there for all sorts of ideas.
Yeah, I'm concerned about the we'll do any photo part.
Oh, thinking the wrong kind of selfie.
Oh, God, yes, because you know people will do that. You know people will do that.
Mom, I need more grey pencils to colour in this elephant.
Just a guy with his pockets out.
No, even better. Get a light blue. Finally fulfil that dream of Dr. Manhattan cosplay.
Oh, that's awful.
I'm making a lot of comic references today.
Yes, we are. Yes, we are. But this has so much potential to go wrong. It has just too much potential to go wrong. Can you imagine if you've basically done that and you put your colouring book, your selfie colouring book to one side, and then you've got nephews or nieces or kids of your own, can I colour in? Oh, I found a colouring book.
Oh, no. That's your uncle's special alone time colouring book.
Yes, for when he wants to concentrate and become one with the world. Can you imagine? I coloured in this snake.
Look, he's crawling into a cave.
No, let's stop there. Let's stop there. Otherwise, we're going to end up with Thomas the Tank Engine references.
Let's keep it much more family-friendly than this colouring book is inevitably going to be.
Yes, we know what's going to happen with this. We have seen the internet. We know what's going to happen with this.
It is going to get horribly misused.
It's all going to go horribly, horribly wrong.
Oh, to be fair, I feel like if they don't already have something in place that's like, no pictures of this kind, they're soon going to make that rule.
Yes. Just inundated.
After they find, like, their lead artist just sitting in a corner with a bottle of whiskey sobbing.
Yes. Oh, right. Okay. Let's move on from the huge potential to go wrong.
Yes. Shall we go back up to more highbrow stuff?
Yes.
So, this is the news that a painting has been found in a French attic, which may be a lost Caravaggio.
Which one was Caravaggio again?
He's the one what drew lots of pictures of ladies doing violent stuff to men's.
Him.
Lots of heads chopped off and what such. So this is the painting of Judith beheading Holofernes, which is from the Bible, apparently, the Book of Judith.
Okay.
She chopped some dude's head off. I forget sometimes that the Bible is actually quite hardcore.
Yeah, it is. I mean, if you look at the story of David, you know, King David killed Goliath with a sling,
yeah,
apparently, and then went on to become king, but then saw a woman taking a bath, thought, she's a bit of all right, sent her husband off to war to die so he could get her.
I suppose that's like not the kind of stuff that's been
servants of God.
You know, I suppose that's like the kind of thing that hasn't been in more adaptions, adaptations or TV versions or whatevs.
They kind of gloss over that little bit. They don't like talking about that little bit.
Yeah, I'm just saying, if we can have angry Russell Crowe Noah.
Actually, yeah. Yeah, that is a possibility.
I mean, you've got your sex, you've got your violence, you've got your Bible, you've got your sand, people like sand.
Well, I kind of, do you know the funniest thing about that whole David and Bathsheba thing? Is that it's like, let's see, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife, thou shalt not kill.
Yeah, Ten Commandments, Ten Commandments.
Ten Commandments.
Ten Commandments.
The Ten Comanches. It's like the Magnificent Seven. Only better, because they make rules.
This has gone very weird. Let's reel this back into France.
Yes, yes. Caravaggio.
Yes, that's where we were. So, yeah. Painting, it was found in an attic in Toulouse. Like, completely unknown to the owners. Literally, they went up there to fix a leak in the ceiling. Found an art painting. But there's currently quite a bit of debate over how authentic it is.
Okay.
With some people saying it's like, it's a fake. Other people saying not only is it authentic, but it's a masterpiece.
Okay.
So I think it's very contentious at the moment. Also, Antimaz is that France has stuck a no export rule on it.
Really?
So yeah. So basically it's illegal to remove it from the country for 30 months while they examine it.
Well, that's fair, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's in their country.
Yeah, that's fair. Okay, so moving on then from Caravaggio to an interesting scheme that they're actually looking to bring in. This is from a campaign called The Reading Well for Young People, and they produce a list of books to help young people deal with mental health issues.
Oh, as in like a well of reading.
Yeah, well, reading well as in well-being and also a well of reading kind of thing.
But you said it's called The Reading Well.
Yeah, The Reading Well for Young People campaign. And these books, you know, young people are dealing with all sorts of things now, and mental health issues are one of the things that they're dealing with. And they want these books to be available at surgeries and libraries. And they've got a list of books, and there's quite an extensive list of books. There are some fiction books in there, but there are also a lot of non-fiction books. And the scheme is following the launch of a similar reading program for common mental health conditions in adults, which was set up in 2013. And one aimed at people with dementia and their carers, which was established last year. The reading agency has said that the books have reached almost 500,000 people in its first 2 years, and that borrowing of titles on the adult list has increased by 97%, while those on the dementia list has increased by 346%.
Okay, so it seems like it's an effective tool.
I mean, there's 35 books on the scheme for young adults, fiction and non-fiction. Fiction has been included for the first time. And there's stuff like The Perks of Being a Wallfire by Stephen Chbosky. And apparently that deals with anxiety as well as sexuality, child abuse, and suicide. So, interesting choices there.
Oh, yeah, actually. I've seen the film of that and I forgot that it does actually get quite in-depth.
Yeah.
I remember it's them being, like, not realizing heroes by David Bowie's by David Bowie.
Yeah. And
doesn't know that.
Yeah. Mark Haddon's The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime is about a teenager with Asperger syndrome, quite severe Asperger syndrome. Thing is, Asperger's one of those ones, it's like any mental health issue. It's one of those ones where there's different grades, I suppose you'd call it. So you can have like really low level Asperger's, but I know several people and I don't like tarring people with the same brush, but I know several people who they will use it as a crutch to justify them being ill-mannered and impolite to people.
Yeah, I've come across people like that as well.
You know, and I don't think that's fair because I've seen people who suffer quite badly with Asperger's and, you know, they really struggle.
It's the inherent problem with having something like this, which is on such a broad spectrum.
Exactly.
is that it's kind of hard to point out to people, like, yes, okay, maybe you have this disease, but you're not as bad as people like this.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the things that I like about this scheme is that you have books there that explain things in a way that young people can actually connect with and can actually understand. And, you know, it makes it clear to them. They actually understand it better, because I've always been a supporter of the idea that rather than just having psychologists and psychiatrists explain everything in kind of a professional manner, why not let young people start understanding things for themselves? Because
yeah,
it's part of being young.
That's what I was going to say. This is why I like that there's fiction on there as well.
Yeah.
I think it can be hard to like deal with something when you're just reading a textbook that talks about in very vague scientific terms.
Exactly.
But when it's a story that's actually like, oh, this is what it's like to live with this disease.
Yeah.
It becomes a lot more understandable.
I totally agree with you. I think that if you've got the knowledge there, but then someone applies it in a story, and that's relatable, you actually understand the story better and the characters better because you've got that background knowledge then. And I think that's a huge thing that will help a lot of young people with their mental health issues. I really, really like this idea.
Yeah, I think it's a very good scheme.
Okay, some of the non-fiction titles are a bit unwieldy and cumbersome. Just to give you an example of unwieldy and cumbersome titles, one of these ones by Kate Collins Donnelly, it's a non-fiction one, and it's for confidence and self-esteem. The book title, the full title is Banish Your Self-Esteem Thief, a cognitive behavioral therapy workbook on building positive self-esteem for young people. That's a very wordy title.
Chef, you've mentioned this twice now, and I really don't like that title.
No,
especially the fact that it calls it a workbook.
Yeah.
I think that's the wrong attitude to go in with it if you're self-esteem.
Yeah.
This is something that you've got to struggle and work with.
Yeah. And if they'd just gone with Banish Your Self-Esteem Thief, that's a great title. It doesn't need the rest of it.
No, it really doesn't.
Because the rest of it is the kind of thing that young people will look at it and go, I'm out. It's too much like a school textbook. Nope. Not interested. Also, one thing I've noticed, right? Because we deal with several people who have mental health issues here. And one thing I've noticed is that geek subculture, a lot of people who deal with geek subculture tend to have mental health issues or, you know, anxiety issues,
yeah,
various things like that.
I think it's understandable given like the level of escapism in it.
Yeah. So I'm just wondering, when will they have a manga-themed or superhero-themed self-help book?
I think that's actually a good idea.
You know, because I think that that's something that it would make a lot of inroads with young people.
Oh, yeah, like relating it to something that they're passionate about is a really good idea.
I think that that's something that, you know, they could really think about, just throwing it out there.
Yeah. Once again, Geek Show, helping the world.
Yes, yes. Saving the world.
For free, by the way. You know, big companies, anytime you want to give us money for these amazing ideas.
Yes. And we had the idea first, so if you start selling it, then we're gonna come and we're gonna sit on your doorstep and stare at you.
Oh, if you were, I was gonna say you'd do something crazy like go after them with legal means.
No. We'll just basically what I'll do. I'll basically just stand just off their right shoulder and smile at them all the time until they give me stuff to go away.
Can I stand in the rain with like my face pressed against the window, staring accusingly?
You can. I'll just stand there going.
Exactly, it's a two-pronged attack.
Yeah,
because they see the rob and they go, oh no, this is too much. I'll stare out the window instead.
And there's you with your face pressed up against the glass, going.
Yes, going exactly like that facial expression that our listeners can't see.
Yes, I know, and we're not taking photos of it because it was bad.
No one in the world needs to see that, Rob.
Okay, so I'm all for this idea.
Yes, I am definitely supporting it.
Anyway, final news story, I believe.
Yep, it's a tragic story.
Oh.
It's a tale of the destruction of art.
Oh.
Because Scott Marsh has, for a reported, five-figure sum, destroyed his masterpiece mural, Kanye Loves Kanye. So this is in Sydney, Australia.
Yeah.
It's just a huge mural on the side of a building. Kanye West locked in a passionate lip embrace with Kanye West. And yes, there is tongue. It's great. Apparently this guy, Scott Marsh, he pitched that the side of the building. And then someone from Kanye West's management team got in contact and like offered him a 5-figure sum just to paint over it. And I think he did take it, but I think his initial response was great. He asked for a 6-figure sum and a lifetime supply of Yeezy Boosts.
What the hell are Yeezy Boosts?
It's Kanye West's line of footwear.
You called them Yeezy Boosts?
Of course he called them Yeezy Boosts, because he is the Yeezus.
Oh, God.
Second coming of Jizzle Crizzle.
Oh, the Jizzle Crizzle. I forgot about that.
And you, as soon as I said it, I was determined to one day work it into a show.
Oh, you did that.
I did.
Oh, I forgot about the Jizzle Crizzle. Oh, and I was all set to do a power joke as well.
You can still make it if you want.
Nah, I can't. The moment has passed.
Oh, R.I.P. Rob's power joke.
Yeah. Well, you know, Kanye West did that song Power.
Yes.
Yeah, it was a joke.
Oh, for the one you like to quote a lot.
I only know one line from that song. I don't remember anything else.
That is the song that you sing in your snooty high-pitched voice.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, my voice isn't that high-pitched, and it's not that snooty when I do that.
Oh, no, it's more like adenoidal, isn't it?
Yes, it is adenoidal. Very, very adenoidal. I've forgotten what that word means.
like very, very nasally.
Yes, that's it. Adenoidal. I like that word.
Yeah. But see, the kind of voice that someone would use if they were going to tell you about their antique coin collection.
Don't, because I've done that.
Oh, Rob.
I had an antique.
Finally, the disappointment goes both ways.
I had an antique coin collection one time. I was going through a phase. I didn't know what I was doing.
You damn kids and your antique coins and your boomboxes.
I was a kid. It was right after my stamp collecting phase.
Rob. You know those heartfelt stories you've told about how tough it was being an Asian kid in a school getting bullied?
Yes.
I'm starting to lose a lot of sympathy for you now.
There was a reason for it.
I mean, as much as endemic racism is a problem, I feel like the stamp collection might have added to it.
Yeah, I know. Hey, at least it wasn't a butterfly collection. I wasn't capturing insects and trying to pin them down on the paper.
Yeah, that's just creepy.
I know, I don't understand that one. I've had moths fly at my face, and I'm like, yeah, get away.
Oh, God, don't even. Moths are terrifying.
And we started getting those huge ones as well. They're like this big.
Oh, God, yeah, I see them sometimes just on the other side of the window.
Yeah, they fly around. You go, what the hell is that?
Yeah, you just have to stand there just looking at you, double glazing, it's double glazing, I'm fine, it's double glazing.
Yep. How did we get onto this from Kanye West?
I think it's just, it is a universal truth. The story about Kanye West will always go in a very weird direction.
Yes, this is true. This is true because it is Kanye West.
Yes.
And I have said this before, seriously, I can also east, north, and south.
Good for you.
Seriously, Kanye West. Yes, I can.
Yes, I got it, Rob. I got it.
Okay.
It's not a complicated joke.
All right.
Anyway, we have some good news from this story.
Oh.
In that a version of Kanye Loves Kanye does exist. Because before he painted over it, Scott Marsh sold an oversized print of it for $100,000.
I like the way your voice suddenly disappeared while you were saying it.
It did. I got a nose blockage and couldn't breathe slightly.
Oh, right. I thought you were just aghast at the amount.
No, I was actually just choking to death on my own mucus.
See, if you were just aghast at the amount, that would have been...
Have you found the picture?
No. If you go to Google and you type in Kanye Loves, just Kanye Loves, okay, and then, you know, it gives you the drop-down list. Just type in Kanye Loves and that's it.
Oh, Kanye Loves Kanye is the top result.
Yep, that's why I was laughing. I wonder how many people have searched for this.
Oh,
And there's so many memes. No one loves Kanye as much as Kanye loves Kanye.
Because to be fair, that is true. There was no one on the planet who loves Kanye West more than Kanye West. I got the signed photo to Kanye. Love Kanye.
Oh.
My greatest pain in life is that I will never be able to see myself perform live.
Oh, God.
Which I'm pretty sure is like an actual quote from him.
Yeah. Trying to find that art, though, that mural. We must see this. Oh, found it. Found it. Yeah, it's been whitewashed. Oh, God. It's.
Oh, no.
There's the butt grabbing as
well. I hadn't seen the full image. Oh, my God, the butt grab. It's amazing. This is the greatest work of art I've ever seen.
Oh, why isn't this in the Tate? Oh, can you imagine, though, if this was in England, we'd look at it and go, Banksy, you've changed so much.
So don't get it, Banksy. What's the political statement behind this one?
Exactly. No, the political statement is, no man should have all that power.
There we go. You worked it in.
Anyway, on that note, shall we take a break?
I think we should.
This is just, it's like a lava lamp. You can't take your eyes off it.
It's so beautiful.
And just so wrong, but so beautiful and so wrong. And we'll be back in a moment.
TV. There's a lot of TV. Even the internet is TV these days. And if there's too much out there to know what to watch and what not to watch, well, tune in to the Geek Show Podcast Network's very own TV show, On The Box.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to Literary Loitering. And now we're going to be doing some books.
Which is convenient, because I've read a book. So I have read Black Wings of Cthulhu, Volume 4, which is 17 new tales of Lovecraftian horror, edited by S.T. Joshi, and produced by Titan Books. So this is a Lovecraftian anthology series. It's basically a bunch of writers doing stuff, not in the style of H.P. Lovecraft, but certainly plays on a lot of the themes he used in his books. So it's all about sort of vast cosmic unknowingness and how small humanity is in the grand scheme of things.
So it's more kind of inspiration.
Yeah, I'd say it's... We covered before Shadows Over Innsmouth, I think.
Yeah, we've done Shadows Over Innsmouth, and I think we've done another Lovecraftian collection before as well.
But where's that? It's more, it's like taking a specific story and kind of giving a new spin on it. This is more a thematic approach.
Yeah.
So it's less, like, less obvious links to Lovecraft.
Ah, okay.
Well, in some of them, like, some of the stories are straight up related to the Lovecraft mythos, but others are more just taking those general ideas and spinning them out in a new way.
See, it's a shame you're not wearing your Cthulhu t-shirt while you're doing
it. I know, I wore my Cthulhu t-shirt yesterday like a fool. Rob.
I know.
Anyway, now that I've got past that second bit of disappointment, I'll go through some of the stories. A lot of these, like most anthology series, a lot of them just fall into the, yeah, that was a good story.
Okay.
But not much to say about it territory. But some of the ones that stood out to me, firstly, was The Rasping Absence by Richard Gabin, which was probably one of my favourite stories in the book. Basically, it tells the story of a man who is a news reporter covering a story that scientists have discovered that the universe is mostly made of dark matter.
Okay.
But basically, he starts to feel stranger and stranger as he goes on holiday. And eventually, he gets obsessed with the idea that he's been infected by dark matter. And basically, the true secret of the universe with all of our insignificance has been revealed to him.
Okay.
And it's basically just him going insane from that.
Wow.
And it's just this gentle gradual breakdown as he goes more and more insane.
Yeah.
And like, you never know, has he actually been infected with dark matter, or is this just some sort of breakdown he's having?
So okay.
That was a good story. Then after that, we had Black Ship Seen South of Heaven by Caitlin R. Kiernan, which I like the concept behind it.
Yeah.
Because it's basically, it's set in sort of this post-apocalyptic world where all the stuff that Lovecraft wrote about with like the eventual rising up of the Elder Gods to take back Earth, that's kind of in the middle of happening.
Okay.
It's basically about humanity dying out. So like I say, it's a cool concept. I think the writing can be a little bit overwrought in places. It's a bit too much, yes, you've established that this is a like a really bad world. You kind of you don't need to keep selling me on the concept.
Ah, I was wondering what kind of context you were using the word overwrought.
Yes.
Because I'd like that word.
It's a good word.
Yeah. But, yeah, okay, I can
see. Yeah, well, it's like, it's, you know, it's characters constantly being, oh, it's all so terrible, shake our fists in rage.
Get off my land.
Yeah. But also, like, I love the ending. Because it's basically the last remnants of humanity just accepting their fate. You know, we're just kind of, yeah, that's it, humanity's over. As a gigantic Shoggoth tidal wave sweeps across the Earth.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
Which I like that image of just like this slow, like massive gelatinous blob just encompassing everything. Everyone going, yeah, this is the end. Then we had basically two stories, which I have issue with their being together.
Okay.
The first is Broken Sleep by Cody Goodfellow, which is one of the ones that's more thematic than actually related to the mythos.
Okay.
Basically deals with this guy who gets basically kidnapped and forced to participate in an experiment where he's forcibly made to go into a dream state. And it chronicles his like insane trippy adventures as he goes through the dreamscape and eventually discovers that there is some sort of Elder God-esque entity which is like cut humanity off from the true dreaming.
Oh, now that's interesting.
Yeah, and it, like then it goes into like this crazy metaphorical stuff, like him sacrificing his own soul to save it and stuff. And okay. Like it's a good story.
Yeah.
But it is then followed by A Prism of Darkness by Daryl Schweitzer, which is basically the idea that John Dee, you know, the Elizabethan mythologist, he is the one who translated the Necronomicon into English.
Okay.
And he was busy. He did that before he died.
Yeah.
And then once he died, the Elder Gods kind of showed him the universe and the true nature of all of it. And I have an issue with two very trippy, very high concept sci-fi fantasy stories next to each other. Because I read them both in one go, and by the end, my brain was leaking out my nose a little bit.
That may have just been his illness. Let's just clarify that.
Oh, no. Like, by the end of the second story, where it's like, his masked companion takes off his mask, and his face was there, or it wasn't there, or it didn't even matter. It's just like, it's all too high concept.
Wow.
Then I think we have We Are Made of Stars, which is one of my least favorite ones because it's written by Jonathan Thomas. And it ties into something we were talking about a while ago of, is it good to read?
Yeah.
And this is written in this strange narrative style where it's like, it cuts out the words the and at a lot.
Okay.
So it's like, it would be like, followed the perp to building.
So it's kind of like Yorkshire dialect type thing.
Yeah, it is a bit like it, as if it was written in a... And it makes it a bit awkward to read.
Okay.
I think that's combined with the fact that it's another guy finds a guy who's doing some weird stuff, turns out he's like related to the Elder Gods and cosmic unknowingness.
Yeah.
Like, and I think that's the problem. It's like, yes, this is just like every other story in this book.
Yeah. I think that was one of the problems I had with Weirder Shadows Over Innsmouth was that a lot of the stories were basically just using the Cthulhu mythos as just a starting point to do something, and then it just kind of, it was one story after another about the Cthulhu mythos. I think this one has broken it up a lot more.
Actually, I disagree. I think this one actually has a worse problem with it.
Really?
Because with Shadows of Innsmouth, you had some stories that were like completely different genres.
True.
It's like you had that one by Kim Newman that's like...
Oh, yeah, this, the Kim Newman one.
It's
yeah.
like old school Enid Blyton, yes. Secret Six-esque adventure story.
Yeah. Okay, well, I haven't read this one, so I've got no basis of comparison. You've read both.
Yeah. And I would say, basically, this book, a lot of the stories are quite similar, so I would definitely say you need to read them in shorter chunks.
Yeah.
Rather than sit down and try and read all of it in one go.
Yeah.
Then, a couple more that, like, some more of my other favourites, which are Contact by John Pelham and Stephen Mark Rainey, which is like this big sci-fi story about a mining ship going to Pluto.
Yeah.
And just finding like this giant obelisk coming out of the planet, which summons like a massive elder god, which is coming to destroy the Earth.
Okay.
And like that one is just some really cool cosmic horror. It's really great with just the massive scope of everything. Just like the, oh my god, this is a monster the size of a freaking planet that is coming to kill us all.
It's proper cosmic horror.
Yeah.
There. Okay.
Like, reminds me quite a bit of Event Horizon.
Ah.
And I do like Event Horizon. Because where we're going, we won't need eyes to see. Oh, crazy yes. Sam Neill. Then after that, Cult of the Dead by Lewis H. Gresh, which, it's one of those stories I'm annoyed by how short it is because I'd want to read more of it.
Yeah.
Basically, the idea of like reinterpreting all the Elder God stuff within the concept of like Incan mythology.
Yeah.
And like that works really well.
Okay.
And it was an interesting idea. And like I'd like to see more of that done.
Yeah.
Then we had, Dark Redeemer, which is another one that had like an idea that I loved. It was basically set sort of in the real-esque world.
Yeah.
Where H.P. Lovecraft actually existed and he was a horror writer. And it deals with one of the characters created called, like, Nyarlathotep, which I'm pretty sure I'm mispronouncing.
Yeah.
But basically the idea is, because this is, like, actually in our actual real world, when H.P. Lovecraft came up with that story, he basically claimed it was based off the most vivid dream he'd ever had in his life when he was a child. So this is dealing with the idea that actually he was contacted by some sort of elder god as a child because he's got like latent psychic talents. And this is like set in the present day with a team of psychic investigators using remote viewing to sort of go into the dreamscape again to hunt him down.
It's Doctor Strange.
Oh, it is. But then it gets even trippier because we find out that actually all of reality is an illusion made up of our shared consciousness. And Nyarlathotep is coming to bring it all to an end.
He's just wearing a t-shirt saying, Jung was right.
Yeah. And then he makes the moon disappear.
Yeah. Jung was right. And on the back of it, it just says, suck it, Freud.
Yes. And then kind of the last, like, well, no, there's two more noticeable ones. Say, like, the last story that I really liked is In the Event of Death by Stymon Strandsas.
Yeah.
Which is kind of like the other side of this, because a lot of Lovecraft stories, basically people find out about the Elder Gods and, like, go mad from the revelation.
Yeah.
And this is basically that, but prolonged.
Okay.
So basically, it's a guy who finds out that his father was like maybe some sort of reincarnated elder god or whatever.
Okay.
And that starts giving him strange, like horrible nightmares. But it details more like the gradual breakdown of his entire life as just like he can't cope with this fact he's learned. Like, I like that because a lot of the time this whole going mad thing is used as just like a climactic point.
Yeah.
And I like seeing someone actually go in depth of it and what, seeing like, look how sad it is, this guy, his entire life just breaking down.
Okay, that's an interesting angle to take.
Yeah, it really is. And then we have our final story. Fear Lurks Atop Tempest Mount by Charles Lovecraft. To Charles Lovecraft, you say, oh, some sort of relation to HP.
No.
He's an Australian author who legally changed his last name to Lovecraft because he loves him some Lovecraft that much.
Okay.
And Fear Lurks Atop Tempest Mount. It's basically a poem, which is like meant to be a sequel to The Lurking Fear by H.P. Lovecraft.
Okay. And I'm sensing a but here.
Yeah, it comes off very much like this is some guy's H.P. Lovecraft fan fiction. Like, I feel like maybe if he hadn't changed his name, it wouldn't be so bad.
Yeah.
But, like, I can't help reading it thinking, oh my God, you are trying so hard to be H.P. Lovecraft. Because he's written it kind of in the same style that H.P. Lovecraft writes.
Yeah.
And I think anyone else would be, like, kind of an interesting experiment. But because it's a guy who's changed his name because he loves H.P. Lovecraft that much, it just comes across as being really try hard.
I'm amazed that there actually is a genre of science fiction, fantasy, horror stories that is Lovecraft exploitation.
Yes, it's Lovecraft exploitation. Like Shaft with extra tentacles.
Yes, Shaft with extra tentacles. Shaft with extra tentacles, yeah. Is just wrong. I cannot listen to the theme tune anymore.
Oh, no. Oh, quick, back to the book. So, like I said, the main problem with this is a lot of the stories can be quite similar.
Yeah.
So it's not a good idea to, like, read them all in one go. You should probably space them out. That's how you get the most from it. But I think, do you know who really lets this book down? S.T. Joshi.
Oh? The editor?
He has done a shoddy job. Like, I've noticed at least one grammatical error per story.
Wow.
Yeah, that is not good. I love his little things, like just missing the S off of plural words, or like the occasional misplaced comma, but it's like... But when it's pretty much every story, it really begins to add up.
Yeah, this is true. I mean, there's, what, 17 stories, you said?
Yeah.
So that's 17 occasions where his abilities as editor have failed in a book. Yeah, that's quite bad.
Which, like, especially because this is all you need to do is just gather these stories, read through them for errors, and then put them in this book.
Yeah.
That's your sole responsibility, S.T. Joshi.
Yeah.
It's not good. So, overall, I'd say it's probably still a recommend. There are some interesting stories in there.
Yeah.
I would say the good definitely outweighs the bad, which I think is the main thing you can ask for in an anthology series.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, my turn now?
Yeah, your turn.
And this week, I got the better of the bargain.
You did indeed.
I definitely did get the better of the bargain. And I have got a lovely, lovely look. Look at the cover. Look at that cover. How can you?
It is a very nice cover. You should probably explain what the cover is.
Okay. The cover is basically of a dragon, but it's kind of the anatomy of a dragon, and it's got all these little lines that lead to numbers, which will be on an annotation somewhere. And I'd love to see the finished image of this. Just have it on the wall. It would be amazing.
Yes, it's like a very Darwinian drawing of a dragon.
Because this is by Marie Brennan, and this is A Natural History of Dragons, a memoir by Lady Trent. And it is... How can I explain this? Okay, let's start at the beginning. This is the story, or rather the memoirs, the origins of the researcher into dragonkind, Lady Isabella Trent. And it's about how she got started into researching dragons and various things like that. Now, this deals with her early life from when she was living with her family. She was the fourth child of six, and she had five brothers. So naturally, she was fairly rambunctious as a kid. And having five brothers and living not really in the centre of town, living in the countryside, you know.
Yeah, they kind of had like a nice big garden where they all run around in.
Yeah, and she basically, one of the first things that she found when she was a kid was this thing called a sparkling. And at the time, when she was a kid, everyone thought sparklings, even though they looked a bit like tiny dragons, they thought they were kind of insects. And it wasn't until much later that they realized that they were related to dragons and drakes and various things like that. And she found her first sparkling, but then it turned to ash by the time she got to the kitchen. One of the maids taught her how to preserve it. And that was kind of her lead in, because she was always curious as a child. And I love the fact that she gets into trouble. There's one bit where she learns about a wishbone, that birds have wishbones and all birds have wishbones. And she finds a dead dove. Pigeon dove, same thing.
Yeah.
Right.
And Fat Bird, whatevs.
The cook who's told her that all birds have a wishbone, right? They don't know what the wishbone's for, and she's curious to find out what it's for, and so she basically borrows her brother Andrew's penknife when she finds this dead pigeon. She's hiding it under a haystack, goes into the barn, goes to the haystack, and she plucks the pigeon and then starts dismembering it. And so there's blood, and the smell is terrible, and you know, she's wearing a dress and everything like that, but she's dismembering it, and she finds the wishbone. She's trying to figure it out, but one of the stable boys turns up, and he's like, what the hell's going on? She's there with a dead pigeon.
Yeah, surrounded in blood.
Yeah, and then she starts covering it in hair to try and hide the evidence, but that's just making it worse. There's blood and bloody hair and dead pigeons and feathers all over the place. Parents come along. Her father's like, I don't understand. Her mother's freaking out because she's a typical mother of that time. And I've got to say, this is kind of early to mid-Victorian period, but fantasy. So it's not actually England, but it is very, very, very English. It's so very, very English.
And yes, I think the mother uses terms like unbecoming of a lady.
Oh, God, does she ever. Her mother practically faints at that sight, like any good Victorian lady does. And so her father summons her to his study, and after she's been cleaned up, and he basically, you know, we can't be having any of this. And her father's one of these kind of, she actually refers to him in kind of, she says he was like a pagan god. You know, he was aloof and distant and we didn't quite understand him, but we always wanted his favor.
Yes. I love that.
It's superb, superbly descriptive in that.
That's like the perfect description of the classic aloof Victorian father, isn't it?
Yeah, I know. And of pagan gods.
Yes.
It's genius. And I love the descriptive nature of this because it is a first person perspective book. And there's a school of thought in writing that claims that writing in first person is easier than writing in third person. And I do not believe that in the slightest.
Yes, well, I think I said before the show started that I think it's the case that it's only easier to write first person badly.
Yes, it's easier to write first person badly. I was actually going to bring that up. Because we did discuss this before the show, and Andrew did point that out, and it is very, very true. It's very easy to write first person badly, but writing first person beautifully, writing it in a way that is good, so very, very good to read, that is this. Marie Brennan has done a wonder with this, because it's not just a book about the origins of Isabella Trent, who has this kind of insane practicality about her, and goes on madcap adventures, you know, finding dragons and exploring and becoming a natural historian. This is also a book about female empowerment. And I never expected that because it is set in kind of a quasi-Victorian period. And it's kind of after Darwin's voyage on the Beagle and before the origin of species became kind of the accepted thing. It's kind of in that period. Between that, you know, I think there was a good few decades before it became more and more accepted by people in general.
Well, I think it's smart because that is the period of like biological discovery, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's when this is set, around that period of biological discovery. And in this world, our dragons, do exist, but they're very kind of standoffish creatures. They don't really mingle. You have drakes. They have one bit in this. It's her first encounter with a wolf drake. And the only similarity between a wolf drake and a wolf is the fact that both of them view sheep as food. And that's it. Or as their rightful food, as she puts it. And that's it. And she somehow manages to, because she has a friend called Amanda. Amanda is a year older than she is. And Amanda is very much into those type novels, you know, the kind of, we call them Mills and Boone now, but during Victorian times, it was very, very much Larser. Kind of thing.
Swooning ladies type thing.
Swooning ladies, yes. Amanda and Isabella get on quite well, right? Even though Amanda lives like 2 miles away, Isabella and Amanda get on quite well because they're both about the same age. And Amanda's the only other girl around that age in the area of the same social status, I might add. So Isabella and Amanda, they're basically good friends. And Isabella uses Amanda. She basically is the spark. She basically puts the idea into Amanda's head. Amanda then thinks that she's come up with the idea, and then Isabella enacts the idea. And she's very clear in this. There's one section where she's very clearly says, look, It wasn't Amanda's fault. This was all my idea. You know, so don't blame her. I'm not blaming her at all. It's my madness that led to this. I'll read a couple of bits from this book in a bit because they are superb. But one of the things that I really, really love about this, I'll come back to the female empowerment bit as well. One of the things I really love about this book is just, for me, after so many books that we've read, I mean, we've read some really good books like Seven Eves and The Pagan Knight and, you know, When the Heavens Fall and so many other really, really good and interesting books. But there was one thing that I didn't get until now. There was one thing that I didn't get, and that was a book that was just, it's like when you're in the desert and you find water. That's what this book is like. It is that good to read. It is so, the dialogue flows, the descriptive nature flows, everything works so well. And Marie Brennan doesn't patronize you by dumbing down the language. If you don't understand the word, okay, that's fine. You can either figure it out from context or you can get a thesaurus. But she's not dumbing down the language for you.
Yeah, it's not her job to write it in a way that you need to understand.
And I love the fact that she hasn't dumbed down the language. She uses surreptitious in the correct context. And the fact that she uses surreptitious as a word.
Yeah, because it's a great word.
Yeah, I know. And it conjures up all sorts of really, really interesting mental images. And if you know what the word means, you know the mental images I'm talking about, right?
Yeah, but if you don't, you can look it up.
Exactly. And that's what I love about this book. She is not dumbing the language down. Now, there's a few authors that we've read who also don't dumb the language down, and I really appreciate the fact that they do that. But with Marie Brennan, and I think part of it is the fact that this is a memoir, right? Because it's one thing that I always avoid is the autobiography. I really avoid autobiographies. And I think that's one of the reasons why I've really taken to this is because every so often you just want something autobiographical to read, but you don't want to read a celebrity autobiography.
Yeah, I mean, I think certainly it depends on who's written the autobiography.
Yeah.
But
and
a
whose
lot
autobiography
celebrity,
is.
Yeah. Like, if it's someone who's actually done something legitimately interesting.
Well, Springsteen's autobiography is coming out later on this year. I'm down for that. I'm so down for that because I am a huge Springsteen fan. But in the absence of that, what have I got to choose from?
Oh, I'm sure Jordan's got another one out by now.
Has he?
Oh, Katie Price or whatever she is now.
See, the problem with you saying Jordan is I'm immediately thinking of Howard Cat.
Yes. Howard Cat, who also, like, doubles as an international supermodel.
Yes. But
I mean, you never seen what happens when he shaves that beard.
No, I don't want to know. Anyway, back to A Natural History of Dragons. I swear, Marie Brennan must have had somebody like me in mind. I'm not saying me, but somebody like me who is a sci-fi fantasy junkie. I love sci-fi. I love fantasy. I love horror as well, you know, but sci-fi fantasy junkie. I am dragon mad in Isabella Trent's own words. She is dragon mad. And I will admit that I was dragon mad for quite a while. It was right after my phase of being dinosaur mad and before my phase of being spaceship mad.
Whoa, 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 whoa.
What?
Phase of dinosaur mad.
No.
Dinosaur madness never dies.
I know it doesn't. When I say phase, it was superseded by being dragon mad. And then that was superseded.
Oh, okay, you just mean you leveled up into being dragon mad.
Yeah, I leveled up from being dinosaur mad to being dragon mad. And then I leveled up from there to being spaceship mad.
Okay, that's okay then.
You see what I mean?
Yeah.
And so dragon mad was kind of that phase in between being dinosaur mad and being spaceship mad for me when I was a kid. And when it happens when you're a kid, you never lose it, as you said. And I absolutely adore dragons. The whole idea of dragons is, yeah, I'm so down with that. If it's got dragons in, you've already got my attention. It could be the worst movie in the world, but if I had dragon in the title, I'm at least looking at it and finding out more about it.
And that's why I will defend the movie Reign of Fire till the day I die.
Yes, it's got dragons.
It's got dragon apocalypse.
I know.
The best apocalypse.
I know. And so, yeah. Anyway, A Natural History of Dragons. Moving on to the other important thing about the female empowerment. Because of the time period that this is set in, women of that time were very much, you know, stay at home. They'll basically be the dutiful wife,
yeah.
Everything like that. Isabella's social status is kind of middle class to upper middle class at that point. Her father was basically somebody who was wealthy enough to buy books on a regular basis. And basically, he knew about geography and history, and he kept abreast of scientific research, but he wasn't an expert. Do you see what I mean?
He was, he's the guy who just, he knows what's going on in the scientific world.
Yeah, he knows what's going on. He knows what advances are being made. He doesn't understand the science behind them, but he knows about them because it's kind of his job to know about them. And because he's the head of a middle-class family, and he has to stay abreast of these things, because when they have social events, stuff like that, the conversation will naturally be between the men of things going on in the world. And if you want to be included in the conversation, then you need to know about these things. You need to stay abreast of these things. Interesting little aside on this, Isabella's mother and Amanda's mother don't like each other at all. It's a beautiful little aside when Amanda's introduced, because what I like is the fact that Marie Brennan, because this is a memoir, it's written in the style of a memoir, written in the style of an autobiography. And she's basically, she's become absorbed with the character of Isabella Trent to the degree where she even abbreviates Amanda's name as just Manda, in the way that, you know, good friends would abbreviate their names, you know. So to Amanda, she'd be Bella, for example. So Bella and Manda, it's the kind of thing that you'd see young friends doing. And I like the fact that she basically has become absorbed with the character enough to basically do that. It makes reading this so much better when you have those little kind of, those little verbal ticks that kind of make the character more real.
Those extra little touches.
Yeah, those extra little touches that make the character more believable. And I wish she was real. I really wish she was real, because she is, she defies social convention by wanting to study natural history instead of the typical female pursuits. She becomes a researcher in dragonology. She goes hunting dragons, for crying out loud. You know, her husband is kind of a long-suffering guy who is just kind of, you know, she's a bit mad, but I love her. He is exactly like that. And it's just a joy to read. And I so wish she was a real person. Marie Brennan has actually made me fall in love with a fictional character again. I don't mean that kind of love. You know exactly what I mean. You know, I wish Isabella Trent was a real person. I wish that, you know, I could meet her and shake her hand.
Yeah, it's that feeling after you finish reading it, where you're actually a little bit sad.
Yeah, I'm a little bit
sad. You don't know this person.
Yeah, because with this, I know so much about the character from reading this, and it just makes me sad that she never existed. But I do want to meet Marie Brennan and shake her hand for just give me hours.
We've gone down to just a friendly handshake now.
Well, no, I'll give her a big hug. She gave me hours of reading joy with this book. I cannot sing this book's praises enough. It is an absolute joy to read.
So sort of like 3 out of 5?
No.
7.5 out of 10?
No. You know what I'm going to say. Yeah. I never give 5 out of 5 to anything or 10 out of 10 to anything, but this is like 9.5.
Yeah, this is as close as can be reasonably expected.
Yes, it is.
Because 10 out of 10 should be like a hypothetical.
10 out of 10 is just a concept.
Yeah.
You know, 10 out of 10 is just a concept. You can work towards a concept. I mean,
because like the one, if you get something 10 out of 10 and then something better comes out, your system is ruined.
Yeah. I mean, there are just a couple of niggly bits with this, which is why it doesn't really go all the way to like 9.9. And these niggly little bits are easily overlooked because it's such an easy book to read, right? Such an easy book to become absorbed in. So it's very easy to overlook them. The story is a little bit weak at times. And I think part of that is because it's told from the memoir perspective. It's told from a biographical perspective rather than as a proper narrative. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so it's going to include parts of her life that weren't massively exciting.
Exactly. And some people may find those bits a little bit tedious. I didn't. I was fascinated, but I've got to be fair about this. I can't just be all gushing and praiseworthy about it. And also, the characters, from time to time, they can be a little bit weak. But again, that comes back to the fact that this is from the perspective of Isabella Trent. And so, some of the characters lacking background, I was happy to accept that because it was told from the perspective of a single person. And it didn't really need to go into the background of particular characters because the meetings with those characters were very fleeting. They didn't really have a major impact on Isabella's life.
Yeah, like, I guess if she only meets Major Westcott once, you don't need to know about his entire military history.
Exactly. That's my point. I've read some reviews of this book, and it seems that some of the people are a little bit too critical about it and may have missed the point, I think. This is an autobiography of a fictional character, or a biography of a fictional character. I can't remember which one's which. Which one is the one that you write by yourself?
Yeah, autobiography.
Autobiography, yeah.
Auto.
Yeah, this is an autobiography of a fictional character. And okay, Marie Brennan is the author, but it's supposed to be written by Isabella Trent. And I think when you look at it from that, you know, from that perspective, and if you treat it as an autobiography rather than as just a straight up story, you'll totally get it.
So it's kind of imagining you live in a world where this woman is a famous celebrity and you want to know about her life.
Yeah, basically. Let's put it this way. If we had dragons in this world and we had a character like Isabella Trent in this world and she wrote an autobiography, all those autobiographies of like Lady Gaga and Jordan and stuff like that, they would end up in the bin because this would be the one that everyone reads.
No, Rob, that's stupid. They would end up in the massive pile of stuff that we have our personal dragons burn. Because if you're not going to use a dragon to burn stuff you don't want, what's the point in living in a world with dragons?
This is true. But yes, my advice to anybody who likes dragons is simply this. Find A Natural History of Dragons, a memoir by Lady Trent. It's by Marie Brennan. You'll find it in all good bookstores. It's out from Titan Books as well, so go to their website. Find it, read it, love it. The praise that has been heaped on this book from like Publishers Weekly and various others, it's well deserved. Very, very well deserved. Marie Brennan, love you. Love you so much. Thank you so much for this book.
Also, we're on the internet, so we can say that all the people who don't like this book are poopy faces.
Yes, they are. They're poopy faces.
That's them told.
Yes. Anyway, I feel refreshed.
I'm glad we've managed to refresh you. But I'm still sitting in the corner, gradually dying.
It's very rare I give gushing praise to something. You know this.
Yes, it is.
So it has to really tick the boxes with me for me to go to that level of gushing. But because I've steadily been going through books, and actually the books that I've been going through have been getting better. You know, When the Heavens Fall and Dragonhunters, really good, really interesting.
Well, we had Newbie and Hobbs slightly throwing that off.
Yeah, and, you know, the ones that I did, I've forgotten the names of them, the time ones, the ones with the Watchmakers.
Oh, yeah, those ones.
The Watchmaker of Eternity and...
There's more books I want to read.
The God of All Things. And,
yes.
Yeah, and those were really good as well. And Tim Akers, lovely, lovely man. The Pagan Knight, really, really, really good book. But so far, my book of the year is this.
Bad luck, Tim Akers.
I'm sorry, Tim. I love you. You're a wonderful guy. Pagan Knight is a great book, but Marie pips you. She just pips you.
Maybe he should try and curry our favour by sending us more free stuff.
We'll see. Anyway, right. Enough of the gushing praise. It's time to end the show.
Yes, it certainly is. If you've liked what you've heard, you can find us on the internet. We are at thegeekshow.co.uk. You can get in contact by emailing at studio@geekshow.co.uk every time.
Yes.
studio@geekshow.co.uk. We are on iTunes. No, we're not. We're nearly on iTunes.
We will be coming on iTunes soon, yes.
But we are on Stitcher. We are on Mixcloud. We are on YouTube. And
yes.
DeviantArt, I think we're on DeviantArt.
Yes, we're on DeviantArt.
We're all over the place. You just come find us. And of course, the important thing is that we are a voluntary organization. So we do rely on the help of our lovely listeners to keep doing the stuff we love. And now there's even more ways you can help us. We do have a lovely, shiny GoFundMe page with an appeal, which I think it's fair to say is probably the greatest written appeal in the history of written appeals ever.
Yes, because you wrote it.
Yes, because I wrote it. This is a play what I wrote. Mark Moore Wise. And If you want something for your money, we also still have the Geek Shop with lots of cool merchandise.
Yes, we do.
And coming soon, we might have a brand new cap, which Rob has a fun idea for.
Yes.
Which we shall not spoil here. We shall keep it as a lovely surprise.
Yes. Just one thing that I forgot to mention with this book.
No, it's over, Rob. It's over.
No, just very, very quickly before we go. And I've just remembered this because in my gushing praise, I forgot about this. But you know the cover, that wonderful cover
of
the book?
Yes, I do know the cover.
You also get wonderful pictures.
Ooh, you do get... That is a big thing to admit, Rob.
I'm sorry, I did forget.
I'm disappointed.
Look.
I'm mainly disappointed that you didn't show me these lovely, lovely pictures before.
How good is that?
Oof. That is some nice art. Which means... No, Rob, we've done this on the wrong show. We need to have done it on 4Panel.
Yes. It's got pictures and it's great. It's high-level picture book.
Come colour it in.
No, we are not colouring it in.
Aww.
It's not a colouring selfie type book, okay?
In which case we may as well just end it then.
Yes, let's end the show there.
So, I've been Andrew.
I've been Rob.
And goodbye and thanks for listening.
And this has been a great book.